This is part three in a three-part series. Please begin with episodes one and two before listening to this final episode. This series discusses crime scenes and murder. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. Over the last two episodes, we've brought you the story of Chairo Garibay Ferreira. On December 11th, 2005, 20-year-old Chairo disappeared. She'd planned on attending church with her family in Olivos, California, but she never showed. Her family was immediately concerned. It wasn't like the responsible young adult they knew. She kept busy with work and family obligations and preparations for college, which she planned to start in the new year. She was also looking forward to that family trip back to Mexico, where she'd been born. She hadn't been back since they moved to the States, and she was excited. But, as we told you before, Chairo would never have that chance. After the family's Toyota Camry was discovered in the nearby Bear River by a passerby, Chairo was reported missing to the Yuba County Sheriff's Office. Her family and law enforcement began an exhaustive 5-week search that ended in the tragic discovery of her body in a drainage ditch area near her own home. According to police reports, Chairo had died due to blunt force trauma. The fact that her remains had been wrapped and hidden in the water had unintentionally preserved her, which allowed medico-legal investigators to perform a more thorough autopsy. But that didn't give them a clear idea of who'd hurt her or why, and her family was left with little to go on. As investigators worked, her family knew only what the public did, that the Yuba County Sheriff's Office suspected that Chairo had been confronted and killed by someone she knew. Officials didn't say why, but there must have been evidence or information at the scene, or lack of evidence, or information gathered from Chairo's phone or something else that led them to that conclusion. The media did release a few important details to consider. Some of these details have been covered in earlier episodes, but there are other small things buried in single lines of articles that could be of importance if they strike the right chord in the right person. Here's what we know about the investigation from the press coverage of the case. The Appeal Democrat mentioned that in September of 2005, 2 months before Chairo's disappearance, she was robbed while at work. An earlier news release stated that Chairo's driver's license was stolen during this altercation, but in a second column, the then undersheriff, Steve Durfer, noted that he did not believe that to be the case. It had been an important detail, of course, because Chairo's address, her parents' home, would have been listed on that driver's license, but all future reports noted that her license was in fact in her purse, which was found in her room. Another fact repeatedly cited in the press is something that we've mentioned in previous episodes, an open window in the family home and a screen laying on the ground. It struck Chairo's mother, Magdalena, at the time she saw it, and the sheriff's department lifted at least one print from the window area. Now, that's something we've told you before, but there's a little more to that story, at least based on early reporting. News station KCRA reported that family members described the area around the window as, quote, newly damaged. And per KCRA, just a few days after Chairo's disappearance, Yuba County officials, quote, sifted through an area of freshly dug up dirt, end quote, they'd identified in the family's backyard, but told reporters that they hadn't found anything relating to the case. KCRA quoted then-Captain Ron Johnson as saying, quote, the way the ground settled, it kind of looked a little unusual, like there could be something directly underneath. It turned out to be nothing. Regarding what happened at the family home, there was also the detail, mentioned in a single Appeal Democrat article, that Chairo had a, quote, confrontation at about 5:25 a.m. In previous episodes, we told you that her family left for church around 5 a.m. The timeline of the discovery of her mother's car, which was seen by the nature photographer at about 9:30 a.m., is another important point. What that 5:25 confrontation might have been was not detailed, but it gives a time frame for when Chairo might have been removed from her home. when former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger originally issued the $25,000 reward in Chido's case, the language released was as follows. Quote, whereas 20-year-old Chido Garibay was kidnapped from her Oliverst home on December 11, 2005. She was considered missing until January 16, 2006, when her body was found alongside a drainage canal in Yuba County. When we first saw this, the mention of kidnapping seemed possibly notable, but not necessarily indicative of law enforcement's theory in the case, that is, whether Chido was forcibly removed from her home alive. So, when we spoke with the Yuba County Sheriff's Office, we asked them about this, and they confirmed that the language is simply confined by what law enforcement can prove in the case, that she disappeared in December from her home and was found deceased in January. In regard to Yuba County, we spoke with investigator Brian Bernardis, who's been working on Chido's case since he joined Yuba County Sheriff's Office in 2018. We went over a number of questions, including his thoughts on what it might take to resolve Chido's case. Is there a reason known to law enforcement, one that can be shared with the public, as to why the family car was taken versus Chido's personal vehicle, such as an arrangement of vehicles in the parking area?
No, there's no real reason known. The only thing we can do is assume whoever took the car, that was just the first set of keys they found. It's just opportunity. It's probably the best way to describe it.
Yuba County Sheriff's Office has put hundreds of hours into Chido's case. The request for a higher reward from the governor, the searches, billboards, 200-plus interviews, it's an intensive effort that everyone here at the podcast recognized. We've seen a representative of Yuba County Sheriff's Office describe the difficulty of this case come down to it feeling cold from the beginning, even as it was being actively worked from every angle. So I have a two-part question about that. One, if you could discuss as generally or specifically as possible, what were the particular difficulties of developing leads in this case? And what information do you need from the public now? What can our audience or locals do to provide information in the case that would be helpful to you?
A few difficulties, I think, from the beginning. We have roughly about a six-hour window from when she was last seen to when the car was reported in the Bear River, I believe it was. The lack of physical evidence in the car, the lack of any finding of physical evidence at the house to speak of, there's no one thing that you can just grab a hold of and say, this is what's going to tie the suspect to the case. I think a lot of people jump to conclusions early on. And so even when the public starts to suspect a particular person, they lose their education. Some of the interviews I've had in the last year, people have gone back now and said, you know, I remember this thing, and it just didn't dawn on me then because I was so focused on this person. The loss of that objectivity when you're talking to people early on hinders an investigation. So I think it's the collectiveness of all of these things together. We don't have that one thing that says, okay, this is how we're going to go after the person. If people were more forthcoming and gave more information at the time, that would have opened up or expanded the investigator's opinion of how this could have taken place. I think it would have helped out if there was any other physical evidence that could have been found. The car was completely trashed in the river, so any physical evidence was washed aside. There were a few other things at the home that made it more difficult, the reason why physical evidence wasn't found there. The only piece of evidence we technically have is the fingerprint on the back window. And even at that, it's become more problematic than helpful.
In terms of that second question, is there particular information that would be helpful more than just a general call for tips from locals now?
Everybody sees things differently. So anybody that has overheard a conversation or has participated in something, I mean, a lot of these searchers who were involved in looking for Chido back then, were involved in a lot of conversations with other folks where everybody's speculating. Some of the leads that came out then were because they overheard something. I don't want to limit it. If you have an opinion based on some statement you've heard, some thing you've seen, something you've read, then share it with us. Nothing can be ruled out at this point. We have some new ideas based on some things we've done the last couple of years. And I think keeping it that broad will help us prove or disprove anything that we know right now.
One thing we heard from Chato's mom, Magdalena, is that she has felt very supported by your office. She's had meetings every year. People call her. She gets updates. And she's felt like everyone has stayed involved in her daughter's case. And in terms of our experience covering cases, this is a very hands-on approach. And we were interested to know whether Yuba has a dedicated cold case department, or is it all hands on deck, a sort of effort that you tackle as you work on active cases as well?
I'm probably as close as they have to a cold case department, but then I have other duties as assigned. They've never had a cold case unit per se. However, when new detectives get assigned to the unit, they give them the task of reviewing cold cases, a handful of cold cases. This is always one of the first. So that's why I say at least 10 people since 2005 to present have pulled this off the shelf and gone through it front to back, looking for something new, trying to give a fresh perspective to it. Just about everybody in senior management here was around when that case took place or participated in that investigation somehow. So it's still very fresh in their minds. We now have a lot of folks at the department who were her age and went to school with her. And so they still bring that with them when they come here. So they have a particular interest in the case, and that's what keeps it going. And we now have a couple of our new deputies whose parents worked the case. And so this case for generations now, it just keeps finding new life. Somebody with new interest in it and somebody who wants to be involved in the case. This is something that is personal to everybody who touches the file.
One thing that we read about in news coverage and that you and I also discussed as well was the difficulty that Chairo's family had getting national news coverage. And one thing that the former sheriff mentioned was he felt like that would make a big difference in the case as well. What do you think that national news coverage can do for a cold case like Chairo's?
It reaches a bigger audience, for one. Some folks, they travel, they're here for a minute and they're gone. There is a possibility, given the group that were directly involved with the family around the time, there were a few people that we've never been able to contact, not even from back then, that may or may not have information. And by reaching a much greater audience, we have a chance of finding that one person that might have heard something or seen something. One of the people I talked to recently moved away within a couple of years and now lives well outside the area, but was able to provide some perspective as far as time frames that things could have occurred. That was just happenstance and luck that I found this name and was able to chase them down. The media could have reached that person before they would have reached out to us. So I think that's important.
From your perspective as someone who has been investigating cases for quite a while, what do you think it will take to resolve Chairo's case?
A little bit of luck, and I think a renewed community interest in the case, and somebody willing to come forward with that piece of information that helps us put everything together. Those things, I think, collectively could get us over the hump in truly identifying the person responsible or persons. This is one of those cases we don't know if it was a single individual or several. We just don't know yet. To limit ourselves to saying it was only one person would probably really hinder our investigation. So, yeah, luck, interest, and somebody willing to come forward.
The most important things that we gleaned from our conversation with Yuba County Investigator Bernardus were that Chairo's case needs national attention, a directly involved local community to reignite interest, and flexible thinking from everyone involved, both in terms of who might be responsible and what might be important to the case. Dropping our assumptions regarding everything, whether it might be something as simple as a text message and its importance, or a call received from Chairo the morning of her disappearance that could help establish a timeline, or a sighting of the Camry near the river, any of these small things could make a huge difference in the case. If a nationwide audience is reached, there's a significant reward that could push someone to submit that tip, that detail, that would resolve Chairo's case. Last episode, we told you that a $25,000 reward had been secured by then-Sheriff Virginia Black, as she hoped that this reward would encourage leads in the case. Nothing developed. That came 1 year after Chairo's disappearance. By 2008, the Appeal Democrat reported that, in regard to Chairo's case, quote, crime scene reconstruction specialists, latent fingerprint experts, and FBI agents all were deployed, and officers from the California Department of Justice interviewed well over 100 potential witnesses, some many times over, but with no success. These details came on the anniversary of Chido's death. Her family held a memorial at St. Joseph's, and it was marked by the media and the community. There was another call for information. After Undersheriff Steve Durfer became sheriff himself, he made another request of then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to raise the reward in Chido's case to $50,000. That request was fulfilled in December of 2009, just shy of the four-year anniversary of Chido's disappearance from her home. This is the highest state-sponsored reward offered in any case we've covered on the Fall Line. It's certainly not the biggest we've ever read about or seen. There are rewards in the hundreds of thousands and even millions out there. But for families to appear on this podcast, who are often facing decades-long missing persons cases or unsolved homicides with no reward offered at all, or $1,000 from Crime Stoppers, it's rare. And maybe, as investigator Bernardis hopes, the combination of a nationwide audience, a significant reward, and time for people to become less afraid or realize that what they know might be important, that will unlock Chido's case. That's what her family hopes for. They reached out to all the nationwide television shows over a decade ago, but they never heard back. Any family facing that kind of long haul, waiting for years for case resolution, goes through a lot, emotionally, spiritually, physically. We spoke to Chido's family about how they approached both their grief and their focus on solving her case, and that's something that they have focused on every year. They host memorials, and they invite the media. For a few years, every memorial was featured. Then the coverage became a little more scattered. This past year, we were told that no media attended at all. Chido's cousin Hansel talked to us about how the older and younger generations have dealt with both her loss and the waiting, the nearly two decades of waiting.
It's kind of feel like that's the closest we've ever been, just because we were meeting the entire family day after day after day for weeks. So it was basically like emergency, all hands on deck. And there's like no end in sight. Like, I don't even know how long that went on for. I think for my grandfather, it was because I feel like he didn't have a lot of the tools to cope with it. So I think it was mostly just drinking and anger and not really knowing what to do outside of that. And then for my grandma, it was definitely just more of like religion and trying to keep the family as close as possible, like physically, spiritually, any way possible that she could. And then for the younger generation, my aunts and uncles tried with like the more Latino news sources to reach out to them and stuff. And then they relied on my generation and my older cousins to create that bridge to do the same with the more traditional American news outlets.
Chido's Aunt Carmen talked to us about everything that the family's done, how they've come together for Chido's case.
Toda la familia estaba ayudando a poner cuando antes de que ella apareciera nos apoyábamos hacíamos tamales para recolectar fondos.
Carmen told us, quote, the whole family helped, even before they found her. We would make tamales to raise funds because we wanted to hire a private detective, but they are really expensive, so we were unable to do it. But we all cooperated to help find Chido. We would also help put flyers with her information in local stores. We did whatever we could. It was hard because we also didn't know where to start or what to do. That's something we hear a lot from so many families, not knowing where to start or what to do. Chido's mother, Magdalena, told us that the support of the community was essential to them in those moments.
Oh, pues sí, me apoyaron mucho, mucho, mucho. Y no solamente la familia, toda la comunidad estuvo siempre conmigo. Mucha gente. Y se lo agradezco mucho. Mucha gente, de verdad. Mi familia y demás.
Magdalena told us, quote, they supported me a lot. Really, a lot, but not just my family. The whole community was with me, and I appreciate it very much, my family and everyone else. In regard to the sheriff's office, Magdalena said, quote, I remember they were very, very active at the time, and I've had a lot of support from them. I've always been in contact with them, except recently I haven't been able to get together with them because of COVID. It's been difficult during the pandemic, but I'm going to start getting together with them again. I always see them around the anniversary. During the past 2 years, I haven't been able to go, but I'm going to start again. For Chido's younger siblings, Junie and Marisol, the dual loss of a sibling and a role model made itself known in ways that were both immediately evident and more subtle, things that they only realized as their lives went on.
Well, I was feeling pretty not the same because before there was always somebody older who I could kind of look up to, but then I kind of became like the oldest, and that's not how I grew up. So I feel like Marisol didn't have the same experience I had, because when Chido was alive, Marisol was even younger than I am. So I feel like maybe she didn't get the same experience. I don't know how much she remembers just because she was younger, you know. So I remember that. And then I remember for a little while afterwards, I was going to that victim witness for kind of like a therapy sort of situation. I was getting pulled out of school like once a week for that, but I didn't do that for very long because I didn't like being pulled out of school. I think it was like pretty much therapy, but I didn't really like it very much. I feel like the questions they were asking me were for someone in elementary school and not seventh grade. And so I didn't like that. And then people started asking me why I kept getting pulled out of school, and I didn't want to say therapy. So I just stopped going. I would say I just didn't want to bother my parents in some way or be a burden. So I was just pretty easygoing for the most part. I didn't really ask for too much. Maybe every once in a while, I guess maybe for like some shoes or something along the lines. But in general, I guess I didn't ask for much. But I feel like my parents are like that. They're not very needy. They're pretty happy with what they have.
I think hearing you talk about it, in some ways, it like changes your understanding of yourself in the world when you lose a sibling, especially in this type of situation.
Yeah, because I do remember hanging out with my cousins who are my age, who have older siblings that were Chido's age. And then, you know, as we get older, my cousin Pedro is like America's youngest sibling. He could like go visit America when she was going to the University of Monterey or when she was going to school at Sacramento State. I just remember thinking that's like an experience that I lost. I can't visit Chido at university or whatever, if she would have moved somewhere. And I would say maybe for like my mom or like my dad, the church, I would say, kind of helped them a lot to feel better about the situation, you know, like the feel like forgiveness in a way. That makes sense. I feel like the church, that community of like my mom being in the choir and everything helped them out in some ways. But I would say the biggest change is not having Chido or seeing how her life could have panned out if she would have had children or if she would have gone to college, having one less sibling in our big family.
I don't know if it's from this experience or not, but I'm pretty overprotective about my family, my kids. I don't trust strangers, obviously. I don't trust anybody, just our family. I would probably say it has to do with what happened. I don't know, pretty overprotective. I don't really trust people. Our family's kind of incomplete now because we don't have her here anymore. As years go by, I wouldn't say it gets easier. It's just, I don't know, like you'd have to accept that she's no longer here with us physically. But my mom's always had, she really reached out to like the church and like having faith and stuff. So I like to believe how she believes that we'll all be together one day again and trust God. Really, she's had a really strong faith, and I kind of like to follow when it comes to that.
Chato's cousins, America and Hansel, felt those long-reaching effects too.
I mean, obviously, when you love someone and they get murdered, it's going to always be a part of you, especially if you start talking about it more. But nobody really talks about it. We talk about, like, we've recently talked about, like, all the girl cousins being like, we need to celebrate her birthday, things like that. We don't really talk about justice or, like, who could it have been as much, because it's been so long. And I feel like if there was enough evidence, they would have already found the person responsible. It does have me feeling a little hopeless in that sense for her life. Because, I mean, we all have lives, right? We all just continue moving along and we grieve. And I feel like grief becomes a little smaller as you get older and as you have kids. And it's, you know, busy time for all of us. But, like, when you do remember it, like I am now, I mean, it's obviously very present in me, in my body, in my heart.
I think everyone has, basically the same picture of Chaitel in the house. So that's like her physical preference is she's always somewhere in the house so that we don't forget her and stuff like that in that way. Like right now in my apartment with my partner, Anna, we already have our Day of the Dead remembrance altars up. So we have a little shrine with flowers and things that my mom makes just surrounding a picture of Chaitel. And then also for Anna's older sister, just so that we don't forget the people that we've lost. So we have that. And then she always comes up in conversation. So that's another way that like she's always there. We talk about her and we make sure that we don't forget her impact in our lives and stuff like that and who she was before all this happened, because she had a whole life before she was put on the news, and we want to remember all that kind of stuff about her.
Chaito had many friends, but two of her closest friends were Ophelia, who you heard from throughout this series, and Ashley, who sent us a letter to read for this episode. For Chaito's friends, staying connected was more complex, but Ophelia tells us that she still checks in with Magdalena. Ophelia calls, she says, most often when she dreams of Chaito. Magdalena has those dreams too.
And she calls me, or I call her, and I have dreams of her here and there, and when I do, I call her and I tell her about him, and she just says, maybe it's just because you want to keep reminding her, and it's just everything, like my dreams, most of them are just like that she comes back, like nothing happened, like oh, I'm back, you know, and everything's back to normal, like she doesn't talk about anything that happened.
You just get to spend time with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of times it's dreams about us being in high school. I don't know. It just comes to that. I have tattoos of her in my arm. So it's like I always see it, you know. It's still hard for me. It is. We always joked around like, oh, when we grow up, you know, we're going to have kids. And my kids are going to be smarter than yours. But my kids are going to, you know, like we just played around like that. Like me, her, and Ashley. It's always like me and her and Ashley most of the times together. Chaito, I knew she always wanted a family. She always wanted kids. She was such a kid person too, you know. She loved her little brother and sister. And when we have our kids, it's like there's going to be so much fun when we all get together and be like, man, look at us now being moms and the kids here. And I guess they were like, oh, Chaito's kids are going to be short. She's short. Oh, my kids are going to be taller, so my kids are going to, you know, like, bully your kids, just like playing around, you know. It's been hard because, you know, I did think about if she was really here, like how it would be. Like, I'm really close to Ashley right now, you know, like she has her kids, I have mine, we get together and everything. We just think like that, like, man, it could be us three, you know, and our kids hanging out and, you know, we're calling family, like, this is your tia Chaito, you know, your aunt Chaito, you know, and this is your tia Fifi, they call me Fifi, you know. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. It's just, it's always in my mind, you know, and like, every time it's just like when it comes to this time, you know, December's coming. So it's like my feelings change. Like it's sad, like because of her that, but then I'm like, trying to be positive because of my family too. You know, I don't want to make them feel like I'm always sad around that time when I should be happy because it's the holidays and, you know, we should still be happy of what we have, you know? And obviously her birthday is always a big one too, you know? April 10th. Yeah, it's still a little hard. And then I think for me, the hardest thing too is that I still dream of her. And when I wake up, like, I don't know, like sometimes I feel, I don't know if it's scared. I don't know, like my emotions are all like mixed up. Like I feel scared, but then I feel happy that I was still able to see her face. But then in a way it's like I'm sad because I know that, you know, she's gone. So like I said, every time I dream of her, I call her mom and I'm like, I dream of this, I dream of this. And like, what does it mean? Like, is it a good thing or is it just me not letting go? Or Mala just told me maybe you just miss all that, you know, and her being there with you guys. And I do. Like I said, she was like a sister to me. A person like that is like, it's hard to find. You know, I'm not saying that a lot of people are bad or, you know, you can't find another person that's happy, that's giggly like her. But I don't know. She was just different. Obviously, doing all this, it's a good thing to keep her alive, especially for everybody that knew her and even for people that don't, you know. Honestly, for me, it's like I just want this to be over. Like, I just want justice to be done. I want closure, you know, for her mom, especially her mom too, you know, because she's still going through a lot. For me, like, I just want to find the person. And me, I don't want to see why. Like, why her? You know, I mean, obviously, can't, you know, wish anything bad on anybody, but why her? She never did nothing bad to anybody. My kids never met her, so when I talk about her, they're like, who's Chido? Who's this? You know, I tell them the story of them, of her, and, like, you know, she was one of my best friends. Oh, okay, mommy. Like, you know, you'll be okay, mom. Like, my kids have really support right now too. You know, they make me feel happy. Obviously, having my family and everything, but I do think about, you know, what if she was here? You know, and like I said, she wanted kids, and I think it would have been so nice to, you know, get together with our kids, and you know, that's that child. I mean, like, those are things that we're never gonna know. You know. Those are things that are not going to happen anymore.
Here's the letter that Ashley, Chido's other best friend, wrote for us to read on air. Talking about Chido's death is still too painful for her, but she wanted to contribute to this episode and to express her love.
Hello, my name is Ashley, and Chido and I were best friends. I'd like to start by telling you that she was an incredible human being. She had a smile that could light up a room. Her laugh was contagious and full of joy. Chido just exerted such positive energy. I have not met anyone quite like her. She had a heart of gold and always wanted to help everyone. She had a mama bear heart when it came to her siblings. She loved taking them with her and just loved them so much. She also had a baby, aka her car. She just loved it. It took us everywhere. As for her and I, we could spend hours talking about anything and everything. It was so easy to talk to her. She was such a good listener. We just connected like family. We would prep together and then play around like normal teenagers. It was just so much fun. She loved listening to music and dancing up a storm. She was so full of life and direction, free-spirited and responsible. She was devoted to her friends and family. Chido was and still is an inspiration to me. I will forever hold her in my heart as one of the greatest persons I have ever met and had the pleasure to call my best friend / sister from another mother. I love you and miss you dearly, Chido.
Yuba County investigators have conducted new interviews with individuals as recently as the summer of 2022 and have developed new information to add to Chido's case. Each piece, no matter how small, builds that essential timeline from the moment Chido's family left for church to the moment that the Camry was found in Bear River. Those several hours are of vital importance, but they aren't the only thing that matters. Anything you've heard about Chido's case or her life in the weeks before the disappearance could be helpful to investigators. Again, so can a push toward national coverage of Chido's case. More people need to see her name to increase the likelihood that a vital lead comes in. Whether you share this episode or suggest her case to national media, please do something to amplify Chido's story so it has the chance to travel. We asked Chido's family how they'd like listeners and the larger community to contribute. Here's what her mother, Magdalena, told us.
Oh, pues yo quisiera que siguieran este, ¿cómo les explicaré? Para que no se olvide, ¿verdad? La comunidad y nadie para que siguiera su caso, ¿verdad? Más, pues sigue el caso, dicen que no se cierra, pero que como que haya más. Como en su aniversario, ¿cómo me gustaría?
Magdalena thanked us for covering Chido's case. She also said, quote, well, I would like for the community to follow her case so that she's not forgotten. Even if the case doesn't close, I would like, for example, that during the anniversary there be a billboard or news to reignite the case. I hope people would do the minimum, whether it be talking about it to keep her memory alive, and hopefully we can do something to help the investigation. We shouldn't give up because sooner or later, we'll know who did this. And hopefully with what you're doing, something miraculous can happen. I really do think it can help a lot because people move on with their lives. But maybe this will reignite someone's memory and they will speak up if they remember something. In that hope, the Fall Line has provided English and Spanish language reward flyers for Chido's case, and we're hosting them now on our website. You can find a link in the show notes. Please feel free to download them and share them anywhere you can. They're printable and also made for social media. Remember, there is a $50,000 reward available in Chido's case. If you have any information, you can contact authorities in the following ways. Yuba County Sheriff's Office has an anonymous tip line at 530-749-5181. Their tip email is ycsoanonymoustip@co.yuba.ca.us. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. And thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Milberg Twins billboard and fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We also have occasional live streams and blogs, which all patrons can enjoy. If you prefer Apple Premium, we've begun that feed as well. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrow. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Spanish translation and interviews by Guadalupe Lopez. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turney. Our monthly donation is currently going to Season of Justice.